This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ho, ho, hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug, the Christmas movies podcast that just wants to find a genie granting unlimited wishes under our tree, if that would be okay, please, and thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Helen O'Hara. I am your host, and we are back today talking about the film Genie. Yes, no big surprise there. This is the new film on Sky Cinema, written by Richard Curtis, directed by Sam Boyd. And it is kind of a remake of Richard Curtis's earlier film, Bernard and the Genie, but updated, taken to feature length, and now starring Papa Asiedu and Melissa McCarthy. So, with me to talk about it today, I'm delighted to be joined by a friend, by a film journalist, Ollie Richards. How are you doing, Ollie?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very excited to talk about this film because I feel like there's a lot to get into. Before you and I start talking, however, I do want to play an interview that I did recently with the film's director, Sam Boyd, just getting into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty, as it were. It's not a very nitty-gritty film, but into the nitty-gritty of Genie. So please enjoy this interview with Sam Boyd, which, full disclosure, as always on Bah Humbug, does include some spoilers for the film. So if you're dying to know nothing about it and go in totally fresh, maybe watch it and come back to us afterwards. Otherwise, enjoy Sam Boyd. Hi, Sam. Nice to meet you virtually. Welcome to Bah Humbug. Congratulations on Genie. I was looking you up online today and I found out that your Instagram name is About a Boyd. So... presumably, it's fair to say that you are a fan of a classic, well-made, character-led comedy.
Definitely, yeah. And yeah, that's been my... I forgot that that's my Instagram handle. That's hilarious. But yeah, I mean, you know, that's a movie I love. And that was produced by Working Title. And, you know, they produced this movie and, mm-hmm. you know, almost every Richard movie. And honestly, like a staggering number of my favorite movies. But yeah, including About a Boy. And yeah, I've always loved the sort of sturdy, commercial, really appealing, but also kind of grounded and emotional and uninsulting character comedy, you know, and whether that's, you know, a lot of these amazing Working Title movies and Richard movies or, you know, Cameron Crowe movies or James L. Brooks movies or any number of filmmakers that I look up to, you know, that was always the sweet spot for me is the sort of, you know, it's funny, but it's grounded and there's poignance to it it was really fun to make this movie and take a crack at that myself.
I mean, first of all, like I should ask, like how did it kind of come to you? How did you get involved?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I made a show called Love Life that I think is on Netflix. It's on iPlayer in the UK, and I believe on Netflix. Both seasons are on Netflix. If anyone is curious or hasn't seen it, you know, and that show is quite a bit different from Genie, but also, you know, not so different in other ways. And basically that was something, you know, that I created, I wrote it and, you know, directed, you know, a good amount of it. And there's no genies there. There's a little bit of Christmas, in one of the episodes, but, you know, largely that was me thinking about, you know, movies like Before Sunrise and Annie Hall and When Harry Met Sally, and just kind of trying to make you know, my version of a sort of contemporary, grounded, sort of character-driven romantic comedy. And then, you know, I had kind of finished the second season of the show and was kind of doing the rounds, making meeting, you know, taking meetings with people. And I got a meeting at Working Title. I had a couple meetings with one of their executives. And at the end of the second meeting, she said, oh, well, there is this other thing we're trying to put together. And it was written by Richard Curtis. And obviously that was super exciting. And she sent me the script and I read it and I loved it. And, you know, and basically I wasn't crazy. So I wasn't like, you know, oh my God, obviously they're going to want me to direct this. You know, I had never directed a studio movie before. This is my first. And so I was just, honestly, I started just being like, maybe I could just meet him. Hopefully I can just meet him. And then amazingly, you know, Richard saw Love Life and really responded to it and decided that, you know, I was the right person to direct this movie. And he wrote me a really nice note and we got to talking. And, you know, I think what was cool about it, I think what he saw, if I had to guess, is that, you know, obviously this movie is called Genie. It's a Christmas movie. It's a big sort of family friendly, all ages, you know, commercial movie, you know, and Love Life is maybe a little sadder or a little more low key or something.
A little
something.
More grown up maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, but I think ultimately like we would kind of joke like, you know, it is kind of like Love Life with a genie in or something, you know, I mean, in certain ways it was like, I think he wanted me to make it because he knew that for the movie to work as well as it could, you needed to believe the characters, believe this guy Bernard that Papa Essieadu plays and his kind of situation with his family and his kind of, you know, moment in life where he's taking, you know, his wife for granted and his kid for granted and his priorities are kind of out of whack, that kind of had to feel as grounded as, you know, some of the stuff I was trying with Love Life. And that if it was kind of all goofy and then there's a genie and the genie's goofy, it would just be kind of, it just kind of wouldn't matter that much. And I know, you know, that's one of the things that's really important to Richard is as funny and as charming and as kind of light as his movies are, as cozy and watchable as they are, you know, it's really important to him that it feels like the challenges the characters are facing and the dramatic situations that they're in, that stuff matters to an audience and that there's a real investment there. Mm. You know, so really it was sort of me, that was kind of the experiment that was kind of fun. What, you know, I think I jokingly, when I was trying to get the job, referred to it, you know, I said, you know, you sort of go in and pitch your take, you know, how you see it. And I think the line I used was Elf meets Kramer versus Kramer, which was obviously like a slightly provocative, you know, comp. But, you know, but that's really what it was. It was sort of like, what if you took this kind of believable, character-driven thing and then kind of grafted this big, fun sort of, you know, studio thing on top of it, this kind of magical fairy tale on top of it.
That's an amazing, amazing comparison. I absolutely love that. But it is, I mean, I really did buy into that side of it. I think partly because Papa is such a likable actor, just in practically everything I've seen him in, he's just got this kind of just big heart to him. He really comes across as likable. But also, I mean, you buy that. You buy that someone could, with the best will in the world, with all the best of intentions, completely lose track of what's important at that moment and sort of do get swept up in this stuff. So it feels very, very grounded.
Yeah, no, and you know, and I think really the key to that is Papa. You know, he's so talented and you know, and that was part of the idea in casting from the beginning was obviously, you know, Melissa's so funny. Everyone knows and loves how funny she is, you know, but she's also an incredible dramatic actress. Mm. And, you know, Papa is someone who's like, you know, straight from the Royal Shakespeare Company and literally playing Hamlet, you know, but also is hilarious. And so to me, it was this kind of yin and yang where, you know, that balance was really important. I wanted it to be a thing where it's sort of like, you know, a hilarious person who can really act and a serious, proper actor who also is very funny, you know, and that if it kind of tilted in one of those two directions or the other too far, that balance would feel kind of odd. And so, yeah, I think the fact that, you know, Papa is this kind of incredible stage actor and has such an amazing sense of his craft was really a big part for me of trying to make the movie work.
I love the fact that, I mean, a lot of the movie is really a two-hander with the two of them. There's a lot of scenes that are, that, you know, it has to be good between them because they are the core and the spine of the movie.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, we always talked about the movie as a buddy comedy, and obviously the key to any buddy comedy is exactly what you're saying, which is that chemistry and Papa and Melissa loved each other. They were so good together. And that's the kind of thing. I mean, it's always, you know, it's the same with Love Life and I kind of made it hard for myself where it's like, okay, each season has its own lead, but then each episode has its own love interest. And then, you know, it's just so many more opportunities to get the casting a little bit wrong or something, you know, it's an uphill battle that I created for myself. But we got really lucky there too. And that's, you know, it's always, you know, the, it's almost a cliche. It's been said so much, but I think it's really true, is just, you know, almost the whole job for a certain kind of movie, you know, and like you said, a movie that is, you know, about people and character driven and performance driven, the casting is almost everything.
So tell me about Melissa, because she's maybe not what people picture when they picture a genie.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, another thing from the beginning was sort of going, okay, you know, obviously everybody has, you know, the genie from Aladdin and I Dream of Genie. And, you know, it's such a sort of well-worn story, the three wishes and everything. And obviously what Richard wanted to do and what we all set out to do together was to kind of modernize it and to flip things in funny and surprising ways to make it feel fresh and make it feel like, okay, you know, you may think you've seen this story a billion times, but we're kind of approaching it a little bit differently here. And you know, and I think for me, again, just going back to the buddy comedy of it all, you know, having Bernard be this sort of classic sort of, you know, Richard Curtis protagonist who's maybe at the beginning like sweet and well-meaning but kind of whatever, you know, a little bit of a fuddy-duddy or a little bit of a, like, you know, oh gosh, he's neurotic and he's kind of making mistakes and we need to see him, you know, fix his own life, and he's a little bit of a, you know, he's got to loosen his tie, so to speak. I think it was really important, and obviously the, you know, the genie in Aladdin is an obvious precedent for this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to have the genie be this kind of force of nature, this kind of larger than life tornado of a character, you know, made real sense in terms of trying to create contrast between the two characters. And you know, and for me, Melissa, you know, having it be a woman, having it be just like a totally kind of unique spin where we were honestly thinking as much about a character like Mary Poppins or something as we were about, you know, the genie from Aladdin or any genie. It was just sort of like, how do we make this feel a little more unexpected? And what's the, you know, what's the version of this movie that people think they're going to see? And how can we flip that on its head a little bit?
Yeah, it is unexpected. But I thought her sort of almost kind of Celtic backstory as an Irish person myself was really kind of fun. And she is great in it as well. I think like that, just, it is that balance that she has between comedy and dramatic roles, and there is a real pathos here to having been stuck in a box for 2,000 years and then suddenly escape. You know, there's quite a lot for both of them to do. So
thank you.
Tell me as well, I mean, like, this is obviously based by Richard on his own Bernard and the Genie in what, 1991, which I believe was also the year Papa was born, which is crazy.
Right.
But it's fascinating. I watched your film, then I went and watched Bernard and the Genie, then I watched your film again. And it's amazing to me that there are some jokes that are pretty much the same both, because they work really well. And then but the whole storyline is so much deeper and broader in this film. And it feels like it's really like amped up a level. So, you know, did you go back and watch that? Did you kind of try and avoid it as far as possible while you were making the movie?
No, I mean, I've definitely seen the original and I love it and have a lot of respect for it. And, you know, and especially that cast that's so incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think obviously casting Alan Cumming in the new one, as Papa's boss, which is the kind of character that, you know, Bernard's boss, the character played by Rowan Atkinson in the original, with Alan Cumming having played Bernard in the first place, you know, that was a sort of Easter egg, obviously a nod to the original movie. And we actually tried, we were hoping to get Lenny Henry to play Papa's dad, Bernard's dad. But sadly the dates didn't work quite. So anyone who's missing him, I'm sorry, we tried, because he's He's incredible too. But yeah, so, you know, it was definitely important to me to have a couple nods to the original movie and, you know, and I love it, but, you know, but also, yeah, I would say, once I saw it, I really tried to just think about our script and our cast and how I would make the movie. I think, you know, the same way an actor who's in a play is probably not, you know, watching footage of, you know, other actors playing the same part, because they kind of want to keep that stuff out of their head and just stay true to their own compass. So, you know, it was a kind of combination, obviously, again, an awareness and a respect for the original, but an excitement and a desire to kind of bring it into 2023 and run with it in the ways that made sense to me and to Richard and Melissa and Papa in this day and age.
I mean, did Alan have any kind of words of encouragement or, you know, reminiscing
yeah.
of this when he got there?
I mean, it was very sweet, actually. He posted a thing on Instagram the other day that was really sweet, that was sort of like, I think he, especially when we were on set, you could definitely sense that he was sort of, I think, touched, moved by the kind of full circle nature mm-hmm. of it. You know, obviously that, you know, I mean, that was one of his first things he ever starred in, if not the first thing. And, you know, it was one of the first things Richard ever wrote. And it's, you know, yeah, 30 years ago now, almost 30, more. Wow. 32 years ago. And yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's, you know, I know you were saying, it's, you know, Papa and I are the same age. So we both basically, you know, both of us are as old as the original movie. But I think that was good and fun. And I think, you know, Alan was touched by that. I think all of a sudden he's like, oh, wow, now I'm the boss. And here's this kid who's, you know, directing it, you know, God knows who he is. And here's Papa, this amazing actor. And he's as old as the movie we were in. And, you know, there's something kind of poignant about that that was really important to me to bring out. And yeah, Alan posted a sweet thing on Instagram, essentially saying all this the other day, where it was just like, you know, this was a blast. And it's crazy that Papa's as old as the original movie.
Yeah, it's really very sweet, but it's lovely to have him in it as well. So, I mean, this is obviously a Christmas movie podcast. So,
of course.
Tell me about the level of Christmassiness that you were going for in this movie, because it's not, you haven't gone kind of full, you know, elf. Maybe it's not fully focused on Christmas all the time,
right?
But equally, that is kind of a sort of. An element, that's a big element in the story at the same time. So, and you were shooting, I think, was it March you guys were shooting?
Yeah, we shot in March. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I think it's funny because it's like Elf, obviously, they had the benefit of like the whole prologue of the movie takes place at the North Pole.
At the actual North Pole, yeah.
Yeah, so it's sort of like hard to get more Christmassy than that, for sure. And we were kind of working within the parameters of just, you know, just the New York bit. And yeah, we shot in March. You know, it was at least actually winter still, which was good. So we didn't have to pretend to be cold or anything and shoot around too many green trees. But, you know, I think for me, you know, it was a funny thing. You know, this is like a little inside baseball or whatever, but if you have a Christmas movie podcast, it's maybe not uninteresting. You know, I think one of the things is me and the production designer and the cinematographer did a lot of research of like, really, how Christmassy does a Christmas movie have to be? You know, and how much of it is just your brain is told, oh, it's Christmas. And because, you know, you get into all these kind of things. And I think especially these days, like, it's a funny thing where you go, oh, in New York, it actually doesn't even snow at Christmas in real life. You know what I mean? It doesn't really. I mean, maybe if you're lucky, but it kind of doesn't. And there's decorations and whatever. But, you know, and it's funny, you go back and watch Love Actually and you go like, is there, how much snow is on the ground really? How much are we outside? How much is the decoration? You know, and how much of it is, again, just your brain being told it's a Christmas movie. Now, that being said, while every time we went back, there was always kind of less Christmas in the movies than we thought or remembered, we still wanted to kind of push it as far as we could, obviously. So everything from snow on the ground, even though, as I said, it maybe wouldn't even be there in real life if it was Christmas, to the fact that, you know, obviously there's all these B-roll shots throughout the movie where it really was Christmas in New York. And we went around, you know, at actual Christmas kind of a few months before we shot the movie itself and got as much B-roll as we could so that it would be kind of bespoke and in the, you know, in the sort of style of our movie to fill out the world and to kind of really sell New York at Christmas time. And, you know, and then even something like the scene where they're talking about Jesus and they're in front of the tree at Rockefeller Center, we kind of use, you know, some movie magic to like make that happen, because obviously that wasn't up in March anymore. But then, yeah, I mean, something like, you know, we shot in March the Santa's Grotto scene, you know, and it's March, but, you know, they built this, the production designers, the art department built this whole gorgeous, huge Santa's Grotto set that, you know, in New York, everyone's jaded and stuff. So they just walk by it and they don't care. But it was kind of funny to be on 57th and 5th, literally right outside where in Home Alone 2, he's like, gets his pizza and whatever. And it's, to me, something that I kind of iconically associate with Christmas. And yeah, we had to, you know, take over a whole square block of the city and build this thing out. But yeah, it was sort of, you know, I think it was really important to try to push that. I think modern audiences kind of need more of that than maybe, you know, people used to think they had to give in a movie like that. And we kind of tried to fill it, you know, even the soundtrack, it's like so much of it was finding the balance of, does every song have to be a Christmas song and whatever, you know, we found a balance that I'm really happy with, mm-hmm. where it's, you know, a number of Christmas songs that are cool and some that aren't, that just fit the scene or whatever. But yeah.
I did want to ask you about the soundtrack because it's a great soundtrack. And
Thank
in particular,
you.
The track over the credits.
Thank you.
Made me very happy indeed. I thought Good. That, I don't know if I should, like, it's almost spoiling it for people, but that was
the superb opening one or the ending one, you mean?
The end credits.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It was really fun.
Yeah, which is, by the way, then that's not even a Christmas song. But again, obviously, as you know, it's, you know, pertinent to the story. And yeah, it was just really fun to figure that out. You know, I think that was a real collaboration between Richard and myself. And, you know, the music's really important to me. I always love figuring out the needle drops and stuff. And, you know, and I think especially with Christmas songs where everybody's heard the same ones over and over again. And as much as I love Christmas, it's like, I wasn't like, oh, let's hear like Jingle Bell Rock again, or just whatever the, you know, whatever. There's ones that are great, but it's like the same five songs, you know? Yeah. And so it was really fun to try to, how do we give audiences that feeling and the kind of coziness of that, but also where they go, hey, I don't know that song actually, that's cool. But it still gives you the feeling, you know, there's a sort of, it's funny because there was I would sort of joke, like there were certain songs that I, as like a music nerd, would be like, oh, it's actually a Christmas song. And then I would play it for my wife or something. She'd be like, I know, but it doesn't feel like Christmas. Like, I don't care that like the guy says Christmas in the third verse or whatever, you know? And it's sort of like, I would refer to them as the like Die Hard is a Christmas movie of Christmas songs, you know, which is essentially like, oh, you can like be a nerd and like mansplain that like, technically, you know, this Ramones song is actually about Christmas. But, you know, if you play it, it doesn't give people that feeling. So it was more about, again, really walking that line, finding songs like the Otis Redding song or like the song at the beginning, this guy, Solomon Burke, where it's like, oh, you know, these are a little deeper cuts, but they still give you that kind of classic cozy feeling.
Absolutely. Okay, I've got two questions that I ask everybody on this podcast.
Yes.
So first of all, we've kind of touched on it already, but what is your favorite Christmas movie? What is the Christmas movie that you have to watch every year, if there is one?
Yeah, no, there definitely is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of obvious ones that are everyone's. And again, movies that I thought about for this movie, you know, particularly Elf and Home Alone 2, which I just love the kind of New Yorkiness of it and the setting and the way they use the city. I will say, you know, obviously this movie is a family-friendly movie. It's for kids. It's for parents and grandparents and everyone. My favorite Christmas movies are a little more adult. So, you know, I love, you know, Bad Santa is a movie that I think is really hilarious, Super. But also very, very sweet. And then there's a movie that I kind of, it's kind of perverse that this was my family's Christmas movie, but I grew up watching, this should tell you about a little bit about the house I grew up in, a movie called The Ref, which is like a really crazy, almost like a David Mamet, like acerbic, like makes Bad Santa look like It's a Wonderful Life. And it's still pretty amazing. It still holds up. So I would say The Ref is a fun one for anyone that wants like a little arsenic in the cookie, so to speak. But but I love obviously all the kind of just, you know, cozy, fluffy ones too. But I think especially having spent a year making a Christmas movie, for me, it's a little more fun to watch the slightly naughtier ones.
that makes a lot of sense. You've earned some time off, I guess. And just finally, this is the other question I ask everybody. Is there a Christmas tradition you have that Christmas, you know, hasn't happened unless you do it? And it may be a food that you have to eat or a particular decoration that has to be out, anything like that, that you have to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many things that I love about that time of year. And, you know, to me, the first thing is, is the sort of decoration of the Christmas cookies, which I always feel like sets things off. And then, you know, there's a sort of sweet tradition that actually with my wife's family, you know, we do this thing where kind of each person in the family gets to kind of host an activity over the few days that everyone's together for Christmas. So for instance, you know, I'm sure this won't surprise you, I pick a movie for everyone to watch and we watch it together. And then I become extremely nerdy and make like fake tickets for everyone. And there's like movie theater candy. And I make like a pre-show as if we're like at the Prince Charles or something. And there's like other Christmas trailers and stuff like that. And that becomes a whole fun thing. And then, you know, my mother-in-law hosts like a family pickleball tournament or whatever. And I, you know, or there was like a, this is not very Christmassy, but it was quite fun and obviously promoted family togetherness, but again, in a, not a kid friendly way, but you know, like a family, like tequila tasting or whatever, something like that. But just, you know, anything that kind of promotes and fosters, togetherness. But yeah, I don't know. That's something that is more late breaking in my life with my wife's family, but that I thought was really sweet was just the sort of, the roulette of everyone, getting to pick an activity.
That is a great tradition. I feel like a lot of people are going to be following that example. Well, listen, Sam Boyd, thank you so much. And best of luck launching Genie into the world. I think it's going to be added to people's list of Christmas classics. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Hello, I'm Hannah Flint from The First Film Club, a film podcast series dedicated to established and emerging talent, both in front of and behind the camera, and the feature debuts that launch their careers. From the new drama Mass to the cult classic Heathers, each episode is dedicated to a film, a guest, and the behind-the-scenes stories, memories, and advice from their time on set. Find us, The First Film Club, wherever you listen to your stripped media podcasts. Come join the club.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
All right, so cards on the table. What did you think of Genie, Ollie?
Well, it started very well for me because right. It had two things I tremendously enjoy in Christmas movies, which is one is set in New York.
Yes.
Which I think is, I mean, it's the best location. Mm-hmm. Give me a stone line with a Christmas hat on, I'm anybody's. And it had a parent who is too connected to their job and just wishes they weren't.
Just missing out on their child's life, you know?
Exactly. They're just trying to do their best. They've got a horrible boss who keeps making them do awful things. And then it really went downhill for me, sadly. I just thought it did this setup. Like, Melissa McCarthy, I'm on board. I mean, she is, as far as I'm concerned, she's the queen of the aeroplane film. You know, anything she's in, you watch it on an aeroplane, you'll be very happy. But I thought after it did it set up that she was the genie, and he'd found her and she was going to help him become the good dad he wanted to be and had lost track of. It just kind of went nowhere. It didn't seem to know what to do with the idea. Like, it's got this big scene of her discovering music and just dancing, mm-hmm. which wasn't very funny. And then it's got that, but I thought the low point was when it had the scene with his family and his in-laws, where they were all kind of supposed to be this big joke of all the weird wishes that people would make, but they were so boring. I thought it was really odd. When I sat down to watch it, I didn't know that Richard Curtis had written it. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised when I looked that up.
Oh, really? So it didn't feel Curtisian?
No. It felt like a very pale imitation of Richard Curtis to me. What did you think?
Well, I did enjoy it, I think. I mean, we're grading on a scale always for Christmas films, I think. So I maybe am a little bit more forgiving of stuff than I would mm-hmm. be most of the year. And I agree with you, New York Christmas movies, like instantly you're giving yourself a head start, especially when it seems actually shot in New York, at least partly. Yep. You know, that makes a big difference because I have seen a lot of those kind of Hallmarky Christmas movies where in theory it's New York, but it looks an awful lot like Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So, but this one definitely New York, definitely had that energy to it, and I really enjoyed that. I really like, I agree with you on Melissa McCarthy. I think always a good plane movie. And the criteria for a plane movie, we should be clear with people, it's not the same as a great movie at ground level, is it? You don't actually want to watch Killers of the Flower Moon on a plane.
No, absolutely not. No, it needs to be, it's ideally a comedy, although an action movie can work, but it needs to be something that requires very little attention and is ideally a bit too long. Like, if you get a comedy that's like 2 hours 20, that's perfect for a plane because it's going to pass a lot of time. But yeah, Melissa McCarthy makes a lot of, she's terrific. I'm not saying she's only in bad things. She's been in a lot of very good things. But she's made a reasonable amount of comedies that aren't necessarily great, but they have a certain level of charm. Mm-hmm. And on an aeroplane, I think you can really forgive that because yeah. you're being distracted by all sorts of other things.
And what I felt about this, some of her comedy performances, sometimes I feel like, she pushes it, she iterates, she improvs on set, she comes up with new ways of doing things. You see some of these in the outtakes of some of her films, you know. And sometimes when what you see on screen is it feels like it's gone a bit too far. Even something like Spy, which I love, some bits I find a bit tiresome, and I feel like, okay, if she'd actually reined it in by like 10%, I think I'd be enjoying this scene more than I am. And what I appreciated about this film is that I thought Sam did a good job of kind of wrangling her and having her work at that sort of 90% mania level, if you like, you know. So she is meant to be this quite larger than life character. In the original version of this film, we should say, so this was originally a 1 hour BBC film, I think BBC, not ITV, I think BBC, from 1991, coincidentally also the year that Papi Esiedu was born.
Oh, that's upsetting.
And I know, very, very upsetting. And actually, Alan Cumming, who plays the evil boss in this, was Bernard in the original. And so in 1991, that this one-hour film, Alan Cumming is Bernard. He is also, you know, working the antiques business. He also has an awful boss, played at that point by Rowan Atkinson. But the genie is Lenny Henry in full flow, mm-hmm. you know, really, really loud, really big performance. I think they were hoping that Lenny Henry would be available to play Bernard's dad in that family scene that you mentioned. And sadly, the timing didn't work out. But that, you know, that really was a huge, slightly unhinged performance. And I think it actually works better to have the genie be a little bit more restrained here, a little bit more reined in. She's still very fun, she's still very colourful, she's still very, you know, loud and outrageous at times, but she's not kind of full on jumping up and down kind of crazy at times, which occasionally Lenny Henry tended a little bit towards, although I actually really enjoyed him in Bernard and the Genie as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem with her and Papa Esiedu. I thought they were a lovely combination. I thought they worked quite well together. I think I have no problems with their performances. It was just that they weren't given the lines. And I agree with you. I do. You do grade on a kinder curve for Christmas movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose there's sort of an argument of how Christmassy is this Christmas movie, really.
Well, that's something I'd like to talk about, because I feel like this is of a piece with another Christmas film, quote unquote Christmas film, that I considered for inclusion on this podcast this year. Now, I don't know if you've watched it yet, because we haven't talked about this, Ollie, but The Family Switch came out on Netflix last week. And that is a kind of body swap comedy where the two parents, who are played by Ed Helms and Jennifer Garner, swap bodies with their teenage children. Meanwhile, by the way, their baby swaps bodies with the dog. I don't think the film does enough with that, but that happens as well. And so all of these people have to, it just so happens that basically on Christmas Eve, all of these people have either the big game, the big interview, the big job meeting, or the big audition of their lives. And suddenly they all have to do it in the wrong bodies. Wouldn't you know it? But it felt like a film that had no reason to exist at Christmas per se. There wasn't actually a countdown to Christmas. The magic in that film that transforms them and moves them around bodies isn't Christmas magic. It's not an elf or an angel or whatever. It's just something to do with a planetary alignment and Rita Moreno reading tarot cards. Not very clear. But this one feels a little bit similar. Genies are not a Christmas thing. That's not something that we associate suddenly with the holidays. And it doesn't have to be at Christmas.
No. I mean, I'm okay with that. I should go back. Extremely on board with the film you just described. Love a body swap. The the curve I'm grading on that one is way kinder. So definitely watching that. I don't really mind if a Christmassy film doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Christmas. Like, I mean, I'm okay with just some twinkly lights in the background. That's fine. I also, sometimes it's just a feel. Like, I would consider Wonka, essentially, it feels like a Christmas film. Because it's all a bit Dickensian and there's snow everywhere for no reason. But it's got nothing to do with Christmas, but it's got the mood. And I'm okay with that. Absolutely okay with that.
I will be discussing that on a future episode of Bah Humbug because, spoiler, we are going to cover Wonka. And it's for exactly the reasons you just mentioned. But we're going to put that to one side for now because there's a whole episode on that. But yes, I agree. And I think in this case, the background does help give you a sense of maybe what Bernard is missing out on when he's missing out on his family. And there is a little bit of that, you know, the traditional reason that filmmakers use Christmas is to give you a countdown. Everything has to be all right by Christmas, okay? And in this case, it does feel like there's at least an element of that. He wants to get his wife and daughter back, but he particularly would like to do it, if possible, thank you very much, by Christmas. He would like to give them that Christmas experience and sort of maybe reaffirm his commitment to spending time with them before Christmas, I guess.
Yes, I think that's absolutely fair. And Richard Curtis, very keen on the countdown to Christmas. As we know, Love Actually really wanted you to let you know how long it was before Christmas. Yes, I think that's absolutely fair. I think, thinking about it, I think the thing I would have most liked from this is a bit more with him and his daughter. A bit, so it felt like, so the rebuilding of that relationship felt a bit richer.
Yeah.
Because it felt like it got to it fairly late. And then it wasn't particularly moving. Like, he bought her a big doll's house, then realised, you know, a big doll's house is not, it's not love, Helen.
That's,
it's lovely.
Very wise.
It's lovely, but it's not love.
I did kind of want to play with it myself, though. Like, it looked...
Oh, me too.
It looked amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah.
but you're right. But I think there is that throwaway line at one point about, you know, what she really wants from you is an hour of your time. And it did kind of feel like that was all it took.
Yeah.
About an hour, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, he didn't seem to undergo a huge change in order to win them back. And he also had to be told to spend time with her as well by the genie, but at a point where I think he should have learnt to do it. I also got the impression that he and his wife had never met each other before. That scene where he comes home and gets told off for missing his daughter's birthday. Mm-hmm. The way they spoke... there were things I liked, though. There were things I liked. Mm. I mean, like I said, the central pairing, yes. Alan Cumming as a mean boss, yes, would have liked more. But, you know, what we got, I'm very pleased with. Setting, good. It was past that that I didn't get a lot from it. I thought tell me how you feel about the direction. Because I thought there was... Sam Boy did Love Life, didn't he? And I really enjoyed that. I thought that was great. I thought there was an unusual indie quality to this. It looked slightly muddy and it had a fairly loose sense to it that I thought it gave a mood that I found a bit jarring with what was going on.
I think loose is a good way of putting it. It doesn't feel like a film that's rushing particularly. I mean, because there's no limit on wishes in this world. There's no three wishes, so he's got to spend a lot of time planning exactly what those would be. That's not part of the challenge at all. He can undo wishes all over the place. That's fine too. So that isn't a limit. That isn't a scenario. It's not like she's going to evaporate in 3 days or anything like that. There's no time limit on this either. He could have her around for the rest of his life, just granting wishes all the time. So there's no time pressure. And it is just a bit, especially in the middle, there is a sort of shaggy dog element to it where they're just kind of wandering around. And I think there's an element where he almost gets sidetracked into showing the genie around. And I think a lot of this comes from the original Bernard and the Genie. So for anybody out there who hasn't seen it, and it is, I think, on YouTube, actually, in its entirety, that has the same setup and some of the same jokes. So it has the bit with the two clips of music. It has the washing the hair in the toilet. It has a few other bits and pieces like that, like literally direct sort of lifts. But it has a completely different plot. So Bernard in Bernard in the original film is also an art dealer, also gets unjustly fired by his boss for trying to do the right thing by a bunch of old ladies from whom they are getting their antiques to sell. Mm-hmm. But also the boss is kind of after him because he has a list of other assets that these people might be willing to sell. And the boss is trying to steal that and sort of frames him for things to get that. And in the original, maybe because Richard Curtis was younger and perhaps unattached when he wrote it, I don't know. The wife is a girlfriend. There is no daughter. Bernard just has a girlfriend and she's basically shagging his best friend.
Right.
So rather than the wife leaving him because he works too hard, his girlfriend leaves him because she's found somebody better, at least in her opinion. So it is it's a really big plot difference and a really big tone shift. And in that case, because Bernard is at a loose end and he has been fired from his job and let go by his girlfriend, like he doesn't really have anything better to do than, you know, run around town with the genie. Whereas you feel like this Bernard actually does.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So maybe that's why you're getting that sense.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that about the original having more of a villain plot line. I guess a big thing that this was missing was jeopardy. So there wasn't really anything particularly stopping Bernard from being better, except for Bernard. Tell me how you feel about the Mona Lisa plotline, because I found that quite strange.
That was also in the original, and is also how Bernard's boss frames him, but he doesn't. Like, he did steal the Mona Lisa, effectively, you know. So they did lift that. I think it's a cute idea, you know, you wish for something absurd like that to show up in your flat, but it has to come from somewhere. It is singular. There aren't a lot of them. So I guess, you know, the French are going to be going nuts looking for the Mona Lisa. I'm surprised by how quickly the fire department leapt to the conclusion that this must be the Mona Lisa, a little bit.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you'd assume a nice cheap copy that you'd bought somewhere, wouldn't you?
Right? You would. But apart from that, I mean, yeah. It just about worked for me, but that is the closest you get to any kind of jeopardy and the closest you get to any sense of a time pressure, because they do have to figure this out before being deported, I guess. But that's about all you get. I was a little bit worried. So we are going to get into spoilers a bit more here, but I was worried at the end of this film that Bernard, you know, he let the genie go and he wished for her freedom. He did the full Disney's Aladdin mm-hmm. at the end, and wonderful it was too. But he doesn't, that we see, make any provision for himself going forward, which, with all due respect to the genie's freedom, I probably would myself. I would probably wish for, you know, my daughter's college fund. And I mean, I don't know how much that flat cost, but his wife must be doing exceptionally well for herself. For anyone working in the art world in any sense to be living in a place like that in New York City. So I would maybe want some money in the bank to get me through potentially a period of unemployment before finding a new job. I would make a couple of wishes before the genie took her leave. And we don't see that. And I get that we don't see that because, you know, Bernard is meant to be a very good and, you know, giving and non-selfish person, but at the same time there's being selfish and then there's just, you know, doing the basics to look after yourself and your family.
Yeah.
You know, am I being awful?
No, I don't think you're being awful, but he does finish the film unemployed and wishless, doesn't he?
He does, and he has used his remaining three wishes on, with respect, lovely things, but quite frivolous things.
Yes. Yeah, I did quite like that. I mean, we're getting into extreme spoilers if we're giving away the final minutes, but I did like how he used them. I thought that was actually one of the best moments of the whole thing.
Mm. That was nicely done.
In the moment, the little things that his daughter wanted were the things that mattered to him most in the world.
Mm. Yeah, that was nice, and it's about time that he learned that at the very, very. Very,
yes.
Very, very
yes.
End of the film. Can we talk a little bit, though, about the genie herself? Because she does get her own sort of arc in this film. She does have a little bit of, you know, exploration and learning and moving to do.
Yeah, which I like. I liked that she has, I mean, it's very similar to the Robin Williams genie in Aladdin, that it's kind of, I'm not my own person. I'm not allowed to do anything that I want to do. And we won't give away what it is that she wants to do, but it's quite humble. I like that. It's nice that she had an arc. And they did actually settle into that reasonably well once they'd been quite manic in the earlier scenes. It did build her reasonably well, I thought.
I enjoyed her learning what she liked and didn't like in the real world. I enjoyed her experimentation with what she should be wearing, what qualified as good in our world. And actually, she ended up on something that did reflect herself, her nature as a genie, I guess, but also kind of, I guess, modern fashion. And then her obsession with Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible, I find totally charming.
I really enjoyed that. Was really hoping he'd show up at some point.
I really was too, yeah. That does, you know, put the original apart again. So in Bernard and the Genie, now in fairness, he gets obsessed with Terminator 2, I think, in that one. So Arnie doesn't turn up or anybody like that. But at one point, I think Bernard wishes to look like Bob Geldof, and Bob Geldof turns up. Or he wishes that Melvin Bragg were there, and suddenly Melvin Bragg is there. You know, there was sort of this, like, British-level celebrities
so what
turned up
be
in the original.
People Richard Curtis knows is basically who she needed to be obsessed with.
People Richard Curtis knows. But you know, I feel like between Sam Boyd and Richard Curtis, they still know some people. And so some of those cameos might have been a little bit fun. But maybe we don't need them. I don't know.
No, it might be nice. An obsession with Hugh Grant, that would have been decent, wouldn't it? Or Anna Kendrick, Sam Boyd knows her.
Exactly.
But yeah, yes, the Tom Cruise thing was fun, yeah.
Yeah, that was amusing. And I would 100% wear that jumper, slightly ironically, but I'd still wear it. Yeah,
no question.
Yeah, I had some of Tom Cruise's Christmas cake yesterday. Actually,
I saw that you had some ordered to the Empire Office, not ordered to, delivered to the Empire Office.
To.
Tell me, what does Tom Cruise's cake taste like? Because it looks—I know it's coconut. It looks like it's heavily covered in parmesan.
It kind of does. Just for anybody out there who doesn't know, Empire has already tweeted a bit about this. I'm not giving away secrets here, but Tom Cruise sends out these coconut cakes. They're a coconut bundt cake with white chocolate chips every year to, I think, hundreds, if not thousands of people, to friends, to colleagues, to members of the press. He sent one to Nick DeSemlin, who's the editor of Empire, and also one to the Empire team very generously. And I blatantly went into the Empire office solely so I could get a slice. I did get a little bit last year as well. I have tried it before, and it is an exceptionally good cake. So it's a kind of, you know, white sponge cake. I think they're making it with, you know, the way sometimes in American cake recipes, they use a pudding mix in there. I think there might be something like that. It's a really, really rich sponge. Is a bit coconutty, definitely has white chocolate chunks in it, and then it's covered in icing and a thick layer of desiccated coconut, and it is an exceptional cake. Like, it's a really great cake.
And do we know, sorry, I know technically this is nothing to do with the film. Do we know who makes them?
It comes from a bakery. No, I don't remember what was on the box, much to my shame, but it is widely known. If you Google Tom Cruise cake, it should come up. And there are even some recipes online. I have tried one of them, which didn't quite have the richness I was looking for. So I'm still trying to, like, really nail that down. But you can make at least a decent approximation of it with some of the recipes online.
And do people know when they've gone on the list, or does a cake just suddenly turn up on Christmas?
A cake just suddenly turns up. Wow. Yes, several Empire. Well, Empire didn't know we were on the list until suddenly one year one of these cakes showed up, and everyone
exciting.
Was over the moon, frankly. Yeah, so it really is like he rappels in from the ceiling and drops it in your lap. I assume after this film that, you know, Melissa McCarthy and company will be on the list.
Must be really nice to receive those cakes. I wonder what a person would have to do to make it clear that they wanted to receive one of those cakes. He listens to the podcast, doesn't he?
He listens. I'm sure he's a Bah Humbug listener. But Tom, if you're listening, please do give us a sign. Send us a cake. Our address is Bah Humbug Towers, London. But yeah, oh God, that would be heaven on earth. But yeah, seriously, very good cakes. We're slightly off topic, but I did love that joke of her getting obsessed with Mission Impossible. I'm not sure what it was doing in cinemas at Christmas time. It's clearly a summer film, but okay.
Also a different studio. That surprised me.
Yeah, that was
like,
unusual,
This is a Universal film and Mission Impossible is Paramount. I was surprised that they didn't go for one of their own. She could have been obsessed with The Rock.
Oh.
And Fast and Furious.
That would have been good too.
He would have done a cameo. He would have.
I don't know. Maybe she's just not ready for cars that fast, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
That's probably the thing. Speaking of the genie as well, she does get a little bit of a love story, which I quite enjoyed. So Marc Maron plays Lenny, who's the doorman. And again, if Bernard here is living in the kind of New York apartment that has those rooms, that view, and a doorman, I feel like, you know, he's been doing pretty okay for himself. Like, somebody in that family is making serious money. But yeah, I thought Marc Maron as Lenny was really charming, actually. He doesn't do that many films, but I'm always kind of glad to see him somehow.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I don't think he did a huge amount in this. It was a fleeting appearance. But yeah, always like to see him.
Always good to see. And we're not just saying that because he's a podcaster, a much, much more successful one. But just, he's got a good energy to him. And I kind of enjoyed the two of them together, this very laid back doorman and this slightly hyper genie. It kind of felt like a match. Again, a change from the original film. So in the original film, Bernard lives in a sort of one of those former warehouses near Tower Bridge. Mm-hmm. Do you know those ones?
I sort of know the type of thing you mean.
Yeah, know the type of thing. And improbably, given that they're only four or five stories tall, they have an elevator man or lift man, we would call it in this country, in the original film. And this lift man kind of doorman type is just fond of telling lies or tall tales the whole time. He's always going, oh yeah, I found a genie once. Oh yeah, I made £1 million. Oh, I don't worry about stealing the Mona Lisa. I stole Guernica or something, you know. So it's all the very, very kind of exaggerated stuff. And this was a much more dialed back version of the character, and I thought much more successful as a result.
Yes. I mean, I think, like you're talking about these things, I think what this film had loads of good ingredients. I think it had all the bones there of something really strong. I think it needed to put some better flesh on those bones, basically.
Yeah.
Like all the
just
ingredients.
Another couple
were there,
of
just,
passes.
Just, yeah, exactly. All the ingredients there just didn't cook it quite long enough, I think. Soggy bottom this had.
Oh, see, Tom Cruise's cakes would never.
Would never. He wouldn't allow it.
He never would. But look, I had a good time, but I don't disagree. I think there's probably a little bit more zhuzhing that could have been done here quite usefully. But I was interested, and I'm very glad it led me to watch Bernard and the Genie as well, because mm-hmm. that was also an interesting piece of TV history that I missed at the age of whatever I was at that point, and kind of have now caught up on. And it was kind of nice seeing Lenny Henry very much in his prime again. Do you remember that period when he was, well, obviously you're a very young man, Ollie, you probably don't remember, but he was on everything at one point on British TV. Anything that was worth watching, Lenny Henry was in.
Oh, yeah.
It felt like, you know, and it was kind of like good to be reminded of that, because he's still very funny, but he does so much serious acting now. He's done Shakespeare and everything. You know, it was kind of nice to be reminded of how big he was in his heyday.
Oh, he's absolute, yes. And also he's just absolutely hilarious when he's, I mean, if you talk about an over-the-top performance, he's a man that even when he's not acting something, like if he's just a guest on something, if you just stand back, he'll just go. He's hilarious. I love him. I think he's wonderful.
Absolutely. All right, so we're, you know, positive in a Christmas movie sense, maybe on Genie, but in a wider sense, maybe could have done with a little bit more of a zhuzh.
Yeah, I think maybe if you are flying around the Christmas period on a plane, not under your own steam, then I would say put this on. Or maybe it's a good one to be kind of doing something else to, like wrapping presents, making a delicious coconut cake, that kind of thing. It's you don't really need to concentrate on it, but it's probably got just enough to be pleasantly on in the background, which is, I imagine, exactly what they're aiming for.
That sounds about right. All right, and Ollie, if people are looking for you, where can they find you online?
You can find me on Ollie Richards on Instagram, but only if you want pictures of my walks in the park or pictures of my dog.
It's a very good dog, though.
It is a very good dog, that's
He's
true.
He's a very good dog. All right, well, thank you very much, and Merry Christmas.
My pleasure. Merry Christmas to you too.
Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Almanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
You just heard a Stripped Media production.